Thank you, Luigi. It's sad that I cannot be with you. The part of yesterday's meeting that I was able to attend was fantastic. So I thought, let's see, I thought I'd give a report on quantification in natural language. As you know, that is one of the planks of logic. Without quantification, there isn't much reasoning than one can do. And through the lenses of quantifiers, to look at what aspects of logic have a direct manifestation in syntax, and vice versa. How does syntax mold logic? And by logic here, I mean the spontaneous propensity of humans to sound reasoning. The point of this exercise is to map out some of the challenges that still face us in our long-standing quest to understanding the relation between language and general cognition. As I'm sure you all know, quantifiers at the most basic level involve relating two sets, a restriction and a scope. So if you have something like three students smoke, students is the restriction and is the first argument of the quantifier three, and smoke is a scope and is the second argument of the quantifier three. And so typically quantifiers relate restriction and scope on the basis of their members. And this includes typically, for instance, comparing their size and so on. Now, some capacity to quantify seems to clearly pre-exist language. And we found traces of it in various branches of the animal kingdom and in the pre-linguistic child. So the question is how grammar shapes up and empowers these possibly pre-existing abilities. Now, in natural languages, we typically found four major classes of quantifiers. And the first one is the one that bears the closest resemblance to the classical quantifier of normative logic. And they include the determiner quantifiers and things like degree quantifiers. And their characteristic is that they are category specific. They target a specific category as their restrictions. The second recurrent family is that of adverbial quantifiers. So things like always, sometimes, typically, often. They feel like temporal operators, but they are much more. The third class can be dubbed alternative-based quantifiers and include things like only, even, or also. And this is a small class, but with huge ramifications. And finally, you get perhaps the signature class of quantifiers in natural language, the polarity-sensitive one, that fall into at least three major subfamilies. Those that like the dark side, that like to be in a negative environment, so things like ever, at all, in years. And then you find those that like the bright side, the positive polarity quantifiers, like some, or at most n, that often have a epistemic coloring. And I expect that you will hear about those from the next talk, and perhaps the most beautiful of it all, free choice quantifiers like any. So is this just a taxonomy based on distribution of facts, or is there a generative grammar at its basis? That is to say, are these four types of quantifiers systematically constructible out of more primitive resources? So let's take a closer look, starting with the determiner quantifiers, the most familiar. you know, something like every Texan is tall expresses that the class of Texans is a subset of the class of tall people. No Italian is tall expresses the fact that the class of Italian and the class of tall people has an empty intersection, and so on and so forth. So the restriction of these quantifiers is created by simply merging a determiner with a noun phrase, okay? The scope is more complicated. The scope needs to be determined somehow. And you know, this can be readily seen by taking any quantified phrase in a non-subject position, like someone fed every cat, that clearly has a reading according to which every cat has scope over the subject. And so you need a theory of scope that to go with this class of quantifiers. And one controversial but important hypothesis is that scope is determined by some form of movement. So, you know, you move the determiner phrase at the beginning of the clause, and then you get a transparent mapping into its usual semantics as shown in 5 and 6. And so maybe scope comes about via movement. The other major class of category-specific quantifiers are the degree quantifiers visible in comparatives and superlatives. So something like John is taller than Bill says that, you know, there is at least a degree such that John is that degree tall and Bill is not, okay? And so in quantifier notation, this is expressed in this way. So the semantics of category-specific quantifiers is uniform, but their syntax varies depending on their on that of their target. Now, a characteristic of this type of quantifiers are they are logical in the sense of being topic invariant or topic neutral. And you know, there are formal characterization of this notion. For instance, in terms of invariance under isomorphisms on the domain of the quantification. And this type of expression of functions are always coded as part of the functional lexicon of a grammar. Another characteristic is that they're subject to a number of language universals. For instance, determiner quantifiers are conservative, where conservativity is expressed in this equation. Also, they tend to be monotone, upward or downward, and this has important consequences for many aspects of grammar, as many expressions are sensitive to the monotonicity of their environment. So to sum up on this class of quantifiers, they target specific syntactic category, hence the name of category-specific quantifiers, as their restrictions. They express relations between sets. They are logical, that is to say, topic invariant. They are subject to interpretive constraints like conservativity. Their restriction is determined by, simply by merge. Their scope needs to be determined in a more complex way, maybe by a movement. And scope assignments is subject to locality constraints. And in turn, it interacts with binding, something that I'm not touching upon, which is also subject to interesting constraint. And a lot of research has been going on as to determine how stable these constraints are across languages. Now, one thing which is important is that this class of quantifiers, though is in some sense the most basic, is also not universally attested. So in some languages, category-specific quantifiers are very scanty. They don't express comparatives via quantificational expressions. And in fact, determiner quantifiers in some languages have been claimed to be totally absent. This is not so for the next class of quantifiers, which is the adverbial quantifiers. So things like John always thinks, or John never sings, which have a clear temporal interpretation. And, you know, so John always thinks, is saying that, you know, some range of contextually determined times is a subset of the times at which John sings, and so on. But very often, these guys have totally atemporal use. So, for instance, Texans are usually tall. He's saying nothing about time. He's saying something like, most Texans are tall. Italians are never tall. He says that no Italian is tall, and so on. In English, they associate in these uses with bare nouns, but in, say, the Romance languages, you would have to use a full-blown definite noun phrase, like I Romani sono sempre alti, I Napoletani non sono mai alti. You, of course, also get mixed uses. So Romans are usually unreliable, has both an atemporal and a temporal construal. So adverbial quantifiers and determiner quantifiers often form parallel series. So some corresponds to sometimes, few corresponds to rarely, many corresponds to often, and so on and so forth. But their syntax is very different. Instead of associating with noun phrases as their restrictor, these adverbial quantifiers are adjoined into the closal spine, and their restriction and scope have to be retrieved via some interpretive procedure. And semantically, they tend to associate with full-blown determiner phrases, which can be either bare nominals, indefinites, but they can be also definite, depending on the language. And sometimes they associate with whole clauses. And moreover, they are polyadic. That is to say, they can bind simultaneously more than one variable. So people usually are grateful to firemen who rescue them, means most pairs, X and Y, such that X is a person, Y a fireman who rescues X, X is grateful to Y. And these guys occur in any language, and they're also the main source of one of the most formidable quantificational tools that natural language has, namely that of generic quantification. So something like John Always Sings has a strong generic flavor where you quantify over worlds with the same nomological structure as ours. So the true form of this quantifier is something like what you see in C. In all the worlds mostly similar to ours in terms of laws and habits, whenever at any time in which the presupposition of the action in the scope, namely singing, are met. So for example, John is awake, is not engaged in activities incompatible with singing and so on, John will sing. So it's a highly complex structure with a deep connection to the tense and aspect of the language. So these are the main properties of the second class of quantifiers. They are merged at various spots in the mid-closal spine between, say, the verb phrase and tense phrase. They are intentional, polyadic generalizations of determiner quantifiers. That is to say, they can bind time and world variables as well as individual variables associated with definite and indefinite determiner phrase. They can go unexpressed because when I say John sings, this is interpreted as John usually sings. And they are, or you know, if you wish, they can be built as part of the imperfective aspect of a clause. They can be monoclausal or biclausal. And when monoclausal, the clause they appear has to be split in a restriction and a scope. And this process is contextually driven and may employ a variety of devices like covert or overt movement. When biclausal, like, you know, if John is sad, he usually eats pizza. The subordinate clause appears to be the restriction. And Again, adverbial quantifier may target various aspects of it, and they are universally attested insofar as we know. Moving on in this speedy run through quantifier classes, another incredibly interesting and beautiful class of quantifiers is that represented by the alternative sensitive one. So John only introduced Sue to Bill, as opposed to John only introduced Sue to Bill. These two sentences have different meanings, but perhaps they have a unique logical form, which roughly looks as the one that you see here, where the scope is just the matrix clause, the prejacent, as it's sometimes called, and the restrictions is a set of alternatives, in this case, determined by focal stress. And only expressed exclusivity says that phi is true, and any member of the set of alternatives which is true must be entailed by it. So this says only phi and what phi entails among the alternative is true. So this is how it would be expressed in the quantifier notation. And the alternative in this case is of the form John introduced X to Bill. So you're saying John introduced Sue to Bill, and if some of these alternatives is not entailed, say John introduced Mark to Bill would not be entailed, it has to be false. Okay? And the alternative set may be determined phonologically, as in this example. Sometimes it is also determined structurally by the lexicon and the syntax, and sometimes even by just the context. And other members of this class are things like even and things like also. And let's take a look at even. Even has a mirative component and an additive component. So if you say something like, I saw even Chomsky, this asserts that I saw Chomsky and presupposes that I saw somebody else, and that my seeing Chomsky is the most surprising, the most noteworthy, the least likely among the alternative sets. Now, one might think this a rather limited class of quantifiers, but the way in which mirative, additive, and exclusive features mix and match across languages is extremely hard to track down cross-linguistically. Just to give you the flavor of it, here is Mandarin Do. And Mandarin Do, associated with a singular referential expression like John Do buy one car, it means even. It's paraphrased as even. John even bought one car. But with a plural, they Do bought one car, it means each. And with a WH indefinite like sheme, it means any. And with a disjunction, it also has a free choice meaning. It means both can teach Chinese. Now, the fascinating thing is that this is not random. And if you want to know how to decompose, on the one hand, even, only, and on the other hand, though, into elements out of which both these elements are constructed, you should read these very beautiful papers. Now, another quick mention is that these guys have massive covert uses. So if I tell you I walk into the class and call John out, you interpret me as saying, I walk into the class and call only John out. And if you ask a question and say, who did you call out from class? And I reply, John, that is interpreted as only John. And these are absolutely systematic. They have been experimentally established in many important pieces of work. And In fact, some of us believe that these covert uses of exhaustifiers like only are at the basis of phenomena like scalar implicatures. But this is a story for another time. So, summing up this third class, alternative sensitive quantifiers are primarily propositionally oriented. That is to say, their scope is structurally determined by their prejacent, but their restriction is a set of alternatives which can be determined in a variety of ways, often by focus, sometimes structurally, and sometimes contextually. They have massive covert uses, and semantically they express these three major functions: exhaustification, mirativity, wow, or additivity, in very intricate patterns. Now, in order to get a flavor of the signature class of natural language quantifiers, I have to talk a little bit about their interactions. And there is this toy example that I kind of like because I think it's very intuitive. So suppose that I have to grade 50 assignments and you ask me, how many do you think you may have graded by 5? Now, I may reply, well, you know, maybe even 40. That's a natural reply. Or I can also reply, oh, you know, maybe not even 1. That's also a natural reply. But if I say, oh, you know, maybe even 1, that's weird. Sounds like a lame joke. Why? What happens? Well, when you are considering a positive sentence, the sentences that you are considering, given the how many background question, is something like, you know, I graded 1, I graded 2, I graded 3, and so on. And this is the range of alternatives that you're considering, and they're ordered by entailment in the sense that if you graded 10 assignments, you also graded 5, you also graded 4. So what happens is that grading one assignment in the positive domain is the weakest of the possible alternatives. And the weakest of a range of alternatives cannot strictly be less likely than the rest. Yeah, because if you're entailed by something, whenever that something is true, you are true. And so you are stating or presupposing that grading one is the least likely of the alternatives, and it can't be. So this sentence winds up having a contradictory presupposition. Of course, negation reverses the entailment pattern, and so now not grading one assignment becomes the strongest, and so that's a natural answer. So what happens in this very simple case is that you compute quite quickly a probability theorem. And the effect, you see, stems from the interaction of an alternative sensitive quantifier, even, and a first order regular quantifier, one. And let me tell you, this is the way in which about half of the languages build their negative polarity items, precisely in this way, by associating a mirative quantifier with a low scale regular quantifier. Here are some examples from, say, Hindi or Tagalog or more exotically Italian. And so, you know, the problem is that even one man came is a contradiction. But it's not the case that even one man came is not. It says something sensible. And so Hindi sentence one is deviant for the same reason why, you know, maybe even one in my example was deviant. The only difference is that in our previous example, even associates with one via background question. So that association is optional. But in Hindi, these two guys are, as it were, glommed together by grammar. And so even is forced to associate with one, and this generates this behavior. And so these are the classes of guys that are wind up reacting to the polarity of their environment. And I would like to conclude this a brief, you know, gallop ride in the quantification in a raw language by looking at the free choice effect, because it's stunning. And to do that, I will also give you a sense of variation in the domain of negative polarity elements. So even negative polarities like the Hindi case or Italian neanche have a strong negative bias in question. So if I ask Luigi, non hai letto neanche un mio paper, did you read even one of my papers? This has a strong negative bias. I expect the answer to be no. But if I say, Luigi, did you read any of my papers? No negative bias. Or did you ever meet Noam? This should be Noam. Again, no negative bias. So one and two have a strong negative bias, which is to be expected because that's what even produces. But three and four do not. So probably we need a second path to the dark side, to negativity. And the second path is also the window into the free choice effect. So let's go through it. So the idea is this, that, and you know, I don't pretend to convince you, I just want to give you some sense of how variation in this domain looks like. Something like English any, it's a regular good indefinite. You know, any comes from the same root as einige in German. So it's the word, the Proto-Indo-European for einig, one, with an adjectival ending. So it means one like. And, you know, these kinds of quantifiers come with a domain, right? If you say, someone doesn't know me, you have a certain domain in mind, no? Because otherwise that wouldn't be news. And so this any is a pure existential, as you see in three, but it excites subdomain alternatives, smaller domains. And so what happens is this, these subdomains are excited, are activated, and so a exhaustification process needs to kick in. And so you plug in a covert only, like you often do. And what happens then is that in a positive environment, you get a contradiction, no? Because you're saying there are some cookies left in some domain, but that's the only domain in which they are left. And so there is no subdomain of that where they are left. And so that's a contradiction. But in a negative environment, there are no cookies in the large domain left. That entails now all of the alternatives. And so nothing happens. Exhaustification is happy. And a negative polarity item is born. So yeah, this may look like magic, but you know, there is evidence for it. Now, what I want to call your attention on is that these guys, that is to say negative polarity quantifiers, have this shape. They are the recursive nesting on a first order basic type one quantifier with a alternative sensitive quantifiers, which can be emphatic even or non-emphatic only, okay? And now, what's the big deal about the free choice effect? Well, here it is. If you say, I will help any student in need, that means every. But if you say, I'll never neglect any student in need, that doesn't mean any, right? It means there is no student in need that I will neglect. Or if you say, if you see any student in need helping, that means the same as if you see a student in need helping. So basically, any is universal in positive environments and existential in negative ones. So any maximizes logical strength, says, interpret me as the logically strongest quantifier you can, given the environment you're in. So it will vary whether it's positive or negative. And this is attested in many corners. It's not just limited to quantifiers. So for instance, this is a propositional connective in Walpiri, Manu, which is interpreted as or under negation, and as and in the absence of negation. So it's completely parallel to the behavior of free choice elements like any. And how do they come about? Where does this come from? And here is a very pretty idea on how it may come about. So consider a background question like, who will invite from class? If I answer John, you'll interpret my answer as only John. So you interpret it in an exhaustified way, okay? And so on. If I tell you, who will you invite for class, John or Bill, you will interpret it as not Sue, okay? So again, you exhaustify the answer. So when you say, when you use on this background something like anyone, which is basic meaning is weak, you have a very weak assertion, but you consider it on the background of these exhaustified questions. So these are the ones that you then exclude, right? So you will saying, I will invite someone, but not only John and not only Bill and so on. And so this winds up meaning you will invite everyone. But this makes a prediction about negative environment. So if you have, you never invited students from that class, here you have negation on top of a disjunction. That's the strongest possible statement that you can make. All the alternatives are entailed, and so exhaustification is vacuous, and you get this flip, sensitive to the polarity. These are the building blocks of the free choice effect. A basic meaning which is weak, exhaustified alternatives, and a process of exhaustification on top of these exhaustified alternatives. And this gives us a quantifier that stays strong across polarity reversals. So this is the structure of the free choice case. Like before, you have first order basic quantifier and a higher order only like element. But what changes is that the alternatives are in turn exhaustively constituted. And so you see this rather elegant recursive use of these alternative sensitive guys. So from typology to grammar. Type one quantifiers are relations between sets. Type two quantifiers, the adverbial ones, are modelized relations between entuples. And type three quantifiers, the alternative sensitive ones, and relations between sets of alternatives. And finally, the polarity sensitive quantifiers are the glomming together in a unit of type one and type three quantifiers. So these are, you know, how we got there. I'm going to skip this. But what have we learned? So we've learned that the identification of restriction and scope of quantifiers exploits to the fullest grammatical resources like merge, move, and intonation. And we've seen that with all types of quantifiers. Building suitable arguments for quantifiers also relies on semantic resources that I haven't touched upon, like binding, which I happen to believe is driven by a dynamic logic. the possibility of having covert counterparts of overt element is very important. And this is something that we know natural language does pervasively. Both, in particular, adverbial quantifiers and alternative sensitive quantifiers easily go unexpressed. And then we've learned that polarity sensitive quantifiers amount to iterated applications of alternative sensitive quantifiers on top of determinant quantifiers. And perhaps this recursive mechanism is even more widespread if scalar implicatures are obtained by alternative sensitive quantifiers. And many agrammaticalities, like NPI violations, stem from contradictions. They are grammatically generated contradictory sentences rather than syntactic constraints. And so, you know, this is all controversial, but there is no question that some of these generalizations are holding water. And the line of understanding will be along the ones, you know, we fight all the time of what precisely determines what, but, you know, it has this shape. It has this level of complexity, and it has this elegance, if you wish. So the how question, how do these things come about? I feel it's beginning to yield. The picture that emerges is consistent with the fact that quantification in natural language may stem from a recursive, structure-dependent use of sparse capacity, pre-existing language. Elementary abilities, perhaps roughly corresponding to the basic Boolean operators and the most basic determining quantifiers, get expanded by the supervenience of specific, very powerful syntactic capacities. And so we come to the ultimate challenges. A realistic picture of the final state of the learning process of quantification converges to our highly specific forms of quantification, of at least three types of which are unattested in any known natural or artificial communication system. No system displays the phenomenon of polarity-sensitive quantification. And no programmer has felt the need of building it in its programming languages. So the learnability issue remains, insofar as I can see, very much on the ground. What is, you know, what should be hypothesized to be the initial state of the language learning process? And what the initial logical resources? And what their statistical ability? And, you know, the idea that the adult language system is bootstrapped out of something very simple and a super powerful statistical or classificatory capacity doesn't strike me as particularly plausible in light of the shape, the architecture of the final state. But, you know, even if that is possible, even with some, you know, super duper, super deep learning enables you to start with your Boolean logic and arrive at the class of polarity sensitive quantifiers, the why question still looms very large. And for that, I don't have no explanation whatsoever. So why are these classes so pervasive? Why are these the ones that the human species is surviving with? Appeals to functional considerations of communicative efficiency come under a particularly negative light in view of the architecture of the quantificational apparatus. Why don't we get rid of some of the quantificational classes in favor of a linear system? Where is the quest for simplification? And it's very unclear what fundamental aspects of communication would be irreparably damaged by, say, not having polarity-sensitive quantifiers. So, in spite of all the progress that we've made, language remains a formidable challenge, it seems to me, in the study of human condition. Thank you very much.